Du lytter til Radio Krishna, en dybere dimension i radio på 87,6 MHz.
At the physical elements with great one spokes and out of duty intelligence that breaks down the physical, explains the spirit soul from authoritative statements of the Vedas, the saints told. Yo, so listen up close while I tell the five groups. The flesh body is a subject that you see that they make most. The first from earth, where the body takes birth. If you analyze this fact, then you see that it's made of dirt, water, fire, air, and the substance of ether. To analyze and understand, just listen, I'll go deeper. Mind, false ego, and mature intelligence. These you can't see, they're the three subtle elements that only makes a beat. When you study the physical gate, analyze knowledge, and it surely will liberate.
I denne afdeling af Radio Krishna skal vi høre en forelæsning givet af Sarabhuta Das fra Amerika. Her er det en optagelse fra Belgien. Det handler specifikt i dag om astronomi. Hvis man kigger i for eksempel Srimad Bhagavatam, som er en af de puraniske tekster, så finder man en beskrivelse af astronomien, som overhovedet ikke stemmer overens med det, vi kan se, i det mindste ved en overfladisk anskuelse. Hvorfor det her ikke nødvendigvis er et tegn på, at Bhagavatams astronomiske udlægninger er mytologi og opspind, vil Sarabhuta i denne forelæsning forklare for os. Herunder kommer vi naturligvis ind på det med højere dimensioner i universet. På det hele taget meget spændende forelæsning, så bliv med os her på frekvensen. Du lytter til Radio Krishna, vi siger værsgo til Sarabhuta efter lidt mere musik her.
So-called supplementary Vedic literature is also called Upavedic literature, which deal with various material subject matters. And one of the subjects that is dealt with is astronomy. So there's what is called the Jyotish Shastra. And you'll see that Srila Prabhupada refers at various times to Jyotish Shastra. Jyotish refers to luminaries, or stars and planets and so forth. So the Jyotish Shastra consists of a number of works. Among them, there is the Surya Siddhanta. There's also the Siddhanta Shiromani. There are different historical Indian astronomers who lived within recent centuries, such as Bhaskaracharya and Aryabhata and others, who have written different works, which are sort of in this basic category of Jyotish Shastra. And then there are other works which are attributed to different demigods. For example, the Surya Siddhanta is a work on astronomy, which is attributed to a messenger from the sun god. The story there is that Maya Danava, the same Maya Danava we have in the Bhagavatam, wanted to obtain some astronomical knowledge which was up to date, because the old knowledge had gotten out of date due to the passing of the ages. This is an interesting idea, that that can happen to astronomical knowledge. So he prayed to the sun god to reveal this knowledge to him, and the sun god deputed a messenger to go to Surya, to go to Maya Danava and teach him this astronomical knowledge. So that's the setting of the Surya Siddhanta. Now this Jyotish Shastra is apparently an accepted part of the Vedic literature and was accepted as such by Srila Prabhupada. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati translated the Surya Siddhanta from Sanskrit into Bengali, and that translation is available. Essentially, it's a straight translation. In one purport in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Srila Prabhupada says that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati compiled the Surya Siddhanta, and as a result of that, he got this title Bhakti Siddhanta. Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati accepted the validity of the Surya Siddhanta. There's a bibliography of the writings of Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, and you will see there that in the period when he was in his early 20s, I believe, he produced two astronomical magazines. One was called Brihaspati, and the other was called Jyotir Vid. And in those magazines, he published many different translations of works in this general area of Jyotish Shastra. So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was very expert in this general area. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, in different places, Srila Prabhupada will quote from or refer to the opinion of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati concerning the Jyotish Shastra. And it seems Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati wrote a commentary on the Chaitanya Charitamrita called Anubhasya. I looked up some of the original commentaries by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati in which he makes reference to astronomical points. And you see there that he, for example, will quote extensively from the Siddhanta Shiromani or the Surya Siddhanta. So he evidently accepted these works as authoritative. So that's some basic background. In general, the Jyotish Shastra is accepted by the Vaishnavacharyas, and it's a traditional accepted body of material. So therefore, it's of some importance to us. So I'll outline the picture of the solar system that you have in the Jyotish Shastra, in particular, the Surya Siddhanta. Now, the Surya Siddhanta is mainly devoted to a system of calculations which enable you to determine the location of any planet in the sky at any given specified time. So if you know the time measured in days, hours, minutes, and seconds from the beginning of Kali Yuga, that's the way you have to measure the time, then you can determine exactly where, let us say, Saturn is in the sky, or exactly where Venus is, and so forth. So that's the Surya Siddhanta is mainly devoted to those calculations. So the basic picture is geocentric. You have the Earth in the center, and you have the Sun out here moving in a circle going around the Earth. Now, Venus, for example, moves in a circle which has its center on the circle of the Sun's orbit. In fact, the center of this circle is the location of the Sun itself. And Venus is moving in that circle. So that the Sun moves around like this, and Venus moves like this. So this is the picture you have in the Surya Siddhanta. Mercury also moves in a circle around the Sun. So it's moving along like that. Now Mars and Jupiter also move on double circle arrangements similar to this, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. The Moon moves around the Earth in a single circle in the Surya Siddhanta system, which is smaller in diameter than the circle in which the Sun moves. This is the picture given in the Surya Siddhanta. So the first point to note is the Surya Siddhanta says that the Moon is closer to the Earth than the Sun. That's what the Surya Siddhanta says. So we'll get to the Bhagavatam in a moment. So this basic way of describing the motions of the planets is similar to the system you find in classical Greek astronomy, specifically the system of Ptolemy. And in Greek astronomy, you'd say that this large circle on which the planet is moving is called a cycle, and the smaller circle is called an epicycle. So the Surya Siddhanta is similar to the system of Greek astronomy, and the established opinion of Western scholars is that Indian astronomy was borrowed from the Greeks. So this is a whole subject which has to be properly investigated. In India, you will find scholars who argue that it's not true that this system came from the Greeks. And they will give many lines of evidence indicating this. But it's a whole controversial area. So this is the way things are described in the Surya Siddhanta. So I should mention that the Surya Siddhanta has a lot of material in it, which is quite interesting. And I will just mention one thing, namely, that you can find in the Surya Siddhanta the orbits, the diameters of the planets in an accurate form. Also, the distances to the various planets are accurately presented in the Surya Siddhanta. For example, in the heliocentric system, if here is the Sun, here is the Earth, and here is the orbit of Venus, as the Earth moves around in its orbit, you draw a line like this, and if you draw another line to Venus moving in its orbit, you see that the basic picture that you get is the same as the picture you have here. You can also draw a line between the Earth and the Sun, and a line between the Sun and Venus, and you get this same pair of lines, like the hands of a clock, which are moving relative to one another in both pictures. Now, in one picture, you say the Earth is in the center, and the Sun is moving. In the other picture, you say the Sun is in the center, and the Earth is moving. But the relative motion of these two lines connecting the Earth, Sun, and Venus is the same in both systems. And the relative lengths of the lines is also the same. In the Surya Siddhanta, the distances indicating the lengths of these lines are measured in minutes of arc. It's a very interesting mathematical system they have. A minute of arc is used as a measure of distance. And you might say, well, how many miles are there in a minute of arc? Well, that's not defined, because, of course, the Surya Siddhanta doesn't say anything about miles. That's an English measure of distance. So one cannot say what absolute distance a minute of arc has, but you can compare relative distances. So the ratio between the distance between the Sun and the Earth and the distance between the Sun and Venus, according to the Surya Siddhanta, comes out to be the same as the ratio between the distance from the Sun to the Earth and the distance from the Sun to Venus in modern astronomy. All the ratios, in fact, come out the same. What it means is that the solar system is being described as geometrically the same in the Surya Siddhanta as it's described in modern astronomy. And this comes out if you examine the information in the Surya Siddhanta. Here's another interesting feature of the Surya Siddhanta. If you see a planet, well, it looks like a star. How many with their eye, naked eye, can see that a planet is a disk? No one can see the disk, at least with the kind of eyesight we have. But here's some interesting information. These are diameters of planets. Now, in the Surya Siddhanta, you're given the value in yojanas. Actually, you're not directly given the value even in yojanas. What you're given is the diameter of the planet in yojanas as projected to the orbit of the moon. But using the calculations in the Surya Siddhanta, then you can calculate what the real diameter of the planet is. If you know what it is when projected down to the orbit of the moon, you can find the actual diameter. So you have to convert the numbers from yojanas to miles. And there's always the question of, well, how many miles in a yojana? It appears there are two commonly used standards for the yojana in India. One is about 8 miles per yojana, which Srila Prabhupada refers to in the Bhagavatam. The other is 5 miles per yojana. Aryabhata uses about 8. The Surya Siddhanta uses about 5 miles per yojana. But in any case, with that calibration, all of these diameters come out to correspond in an interesting way. For example, for the moon, you have 2400 versus 2160. It's quite close. For Mercury, 3008 versus 3100. Now for Venus, it's about half The diameter given here is about half of the modern diameter, very close to half. What is the actual ratio? I have it written here. It's 1.89 is the ratio. For Earth, they're nearly the same, 8,000 versus 7,928. For Mars, it's quite close. For Jupiter, again, it's almost precisely one half. And for Saturn, it's very close. What I would suggest is that the two cases here where it comes out to one half, actually the Sirius Sedanta has the radius instead of the diameter. At least that's a possibility. In any case, you find a lot of accurate figures here for diameters of planets in the Sirius Sedanta. So that's just an interesting point to make concerning the Sirius Sedanta, because how could anyone have known these diameters in India at a time before the invention of the telescope? You see, with the naked eye, as far as I know, practically no one can even see that the planets have disks. What to speak of measuring the diameter of the disk? The method used today to measure the diameter of a planet involves two things. First of all, you know accurately how far away the planet is. Then, using a telescope, you very accurately measure the angle subtended by that planet. And if you know an angle, and you know the distance of a line, say going from here to here, so if you can measure this angle, and you know this distance, then you can determine this length of this line. So that's the method they use to find the diameters of the planets today. So you need a telescope, definitely, using their method, plus accurate knowledge of the distances. So how did they do it when the Sirius Sedanta was written? Because some of these figures are definitely accurate, and these that are nearly one half are also suggestive that there's just an error in the text putting down radius rather than diameter. So it's an interesting point. According to scholars, the Sirius Sedanta was written in the Middle Ages. They try to make all Vedic things relatively recent. But in the Middle Ages, what could they have done to measure diameters of planets in India? So that's some information concerning the Sirius Sedanta. These basic planets of Mercury, Venus, the Earth, and so forth, Mars, Saturn, and Jupiter, these have been known in India for a very long time and also in the West for a very long time. In fact, the days of the week are named after them. Monday is Moon Day. Tuesday, Mars, like Martes in Spanish. I guess in French you have Mardi, referring to Mars. In Anglo-Saxon, Tus was the god of war also. So Tuesday, it's the same thing. Wednesday, that was named after Odin. You know, Odin's day. And that's associated with Mercury. Wednesday is the day of Mercury, and so forth. The same thing is there in India. The days of the week are also named after the planets. There's Sukra Bar, Brihaspati Bar. Brihaspati is used to refer to Jupiter, and so forth. The next thing then to do is discuss the fifth canto. So this is an introduction to some of the material in the Sirius Sedanta and in the Jyotisha Shastra in general. So now, in addition to that, we have the descriptions of the universe found in the fifth canto of the Bhagavatam, in the Puranic literature in general. Also in the Mahabharata, you find this kind of description. In all these literatures, one basic description is given, although in some Puranas the names get shifted around to some extent. So the basic picture that you have is the following. The central feature of the universe, according to the fifth canto, is something called Bhumandala. Bhumandala is described as being a disk about 4 billion miles in diameter, or 50 koti yojanas, using 8 miles per yojana. That's where the 4 billion mile figure comes from. Koti is 10 million, so 50 10 millions of yojanas is the diameter of Bhumandala. So I'm showing this from the side. So it's like a thin, flat plate with a very large diameter, with a diameter of 2 billion miles. To compare that with the Western picture of the solar system, you go out to 3 times the orbital radius of Saturn. That gives you an idea of the scale of size there. So this Bhoomandala is called the Earthly Planetary System. And it's described that there are 14 planetary systems, which are essentially planes. So there are 7 planes going above Bhoomandala and 6 below, which with Bhoomandala makes a total of 14. So those, the ones above are called the upper planetary systems, and the ones below are called the lower planetary systems, and Bhoomandala is the middle planetary system. So these 3 divisions are called the 3 worlds, upper, middle, and lower. So that's the basic description. So this Bhoomandala is described as existing within a large spherical space. The upper planetary systems are ranged above that. They culminate finally in Brahmaloka or Satyaloka, which is the place of residence of Brahma. Then there's different planets of great sages or planes or planetary systems of great sages, such as Tapaloka, Maharloka, and Janaloka. There's Svargaloka, which is the realm of the demigods. Below Bhoomandala, there are the lower planetary systems. Interestingly enough, in the Bhagavatam, the distances are described in such a way that these are extremely close to the plane of Bhoomandala itself. So it's as though you have a stack of phonograph records that are right next to one another. So there are these planetary systems. Below them, there are the hellish worlds. And below that, there's the Garbhadak ocean, where Garbhadakshai Vishnu is situated on Anantashesha. And the region below is filled with the Garbhadak ocean. So that's the basic description seen in a cross section. Now, in the center of Bhoomandala, there is a place called Jambudweep, which we can locate right here. Now, one also wants to look down on Bhoomandala from above. This is seen from the side. But if you look down from the vertical direction, you get the following picture. Bhoomandala is a large disk. So you have a big circle like that. And in the center is Jambudweep. And it's described that there's a series of ring-shaped oceans and islands. There's Jambudweep, which is a circular island. There's an ocean, the salt ocean, surrounding that. Then there's a ring-shaped region of land with a thickness or width twice the width of the salt ocean surrounding that. I believe that one is called Plakshadweep. Then there's an ocean of thickness equal to that ring. Then another ring-shaped region of land, once again, twice as wide as that ocean, and so on for a series of 7 ring-shaped islands with corresponding oceans. And these 7 islands are called Saptadweep, with Jambudweep counted as the innermost one. So this is the layout on the surface of Bhoomandala. Jambudweep itself is very large. It's described as being 100,000 yojanas in diameter, that disk. So if you consider a yojana to be 8 miles, then that's 800,000 miles. So Jambudweep itself has a structure which is described in detail in the 5th canto of the Bhagavatam. It's divided into 9 varshas by different mountain ranges. And in the center, there's a mountain called Mount Meru. So all the distances and sizes in the description of Bhoomandala, including the description of Jambudweep, are on what you might call a celestial level. Everything is extremely large. For example, a typical height for a range of mountains in Jambudweep would be 10,000 yojanas, which would come to 80,000 miles. And for comparison, the circumference of the Earth going around the equator is about 25,000 miles. So you have mountains which you couldn't fit onto the Earth as we know it, as a small globe. So this Bhumandala, which is being described, is quite different from the Earth as we know it. It's a completely different structure. So that's a basic outline of a few features of the universe as described in the fifth canto. So the immediate question that one encounters then is, how does this system, as described here, relate to the solar system as we understand it in Western terms? And indeed, how does it relate with the solar system as described in the Jyotisha Shastra? Because in the Surya Siddhanta, the Earth is also described as a small globe. That's true in all of the different Jyotisha Shastras. And as I indicated there, the diameter of the Earth is almost exactly the diameter as it's understood today. So then the question is, if the Earth is described that way in the Jyotisha Shastra, and this way in the fifth canto of the Bhagavatam, how do you relate those two things? So this question is not new. As a matter of fact, if you look in the commentaries on the Bhagavatam, which Srila Prabhupada was using in writing his purports, their large green books of commentaries, you'll find that some of the commentators actually discuss this issue. In fact, there's one commentator named Vamsidhar, who I understand was a contemporary or close follower of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. But he has a commentary in which he directly poses this very question. He says, well, on the one hand, in the Jyotisha Shastra, the earth is an egg of clay, so and so many yojanas in circumference. He uses the figure 5,000 yojanas in circumference. On the other hand, according to the Bhagavatam, the earth is a gigantic disk, 50 koti yojanas in diameter. So how can we reconcile these two descriptions? It would appear that Vyasadeva has introduced contradictions into the Vedic literature. This is what he says. And then he answers this doubt by saying, actually, Vyasadeva hasn't introduced any contradictions, and he goes on to explain how these various concepts relate to one another. And it would be nice to get a good translation of his explanation. But Sanskrit is very difficult because he uses many words for which we really don't know the meaning. It's very hard to know what he meant. But in any event, the whole subject is discussed even in the commentaries on the Srimad Bhagavatam by previous acharyas. So one basic point that you can definitely make is that this Bhumandala is not the same thing as the Earth as we know it. It's an entirely different conception. And Bhumandala is predominantly celestial. You can see that just by doing a mathematical calculation. If the diameter here is 2 billion miles, and if you can go all the way around the Earth as we know it in 25,000 miles, then it must be that the overwhelming major portion of Bhumandala is far away from the Earth in what we call outer space. Because what is 25,000 compared to 2 billion? So Bhumandala is mainly out there in the heavens. Now, if you read the fifth canto, you'll find that all of Bhumandala is populated, but only in the particular part of Jambudvip known as Bharat Varsha do you have human life as we know it. In all the other Varshas of Jambudvip and in all of these different dvipas of Bhumandala, you have life on the level of, you might say, lower demigods. The inhabitants there live, say, for a period of 10,000 years typically. They never show signs of old age. Their bodies never get wrinkled or produce bad smells. There are very opulent circumstances. And it's described that these personalities have descended from the heavenly planets, but they still have some pious karma remaining. So they're living in an opulent situation in these different parts of Bhumandala, using up their remaining pious credit. So you don't find ordinary human beings who get cardiac conditions and pot bellies and so forth in this region. Now, it is also a fact there's another nomenclature describing the upper, middle, and lower planetary systems. That is, that the upper system is called Svarga, which means heavens. The middle system is called Bauma Svarga. And the lower planetary systems are called Bila Svarga. So you have three Svargas. The word for heavens is used for all three of them. So essentially there is the heavenly region proper, then there's the earthly heaven, and the subterranean heaven. So in the Bhagavatam, you can read about Bila Svarga, which is the subterranean heavenly planets. So all of these things are referred to as heavens, and the inhabitants are primarily like demigods. To get an idea of life there, you can read the description of the liberation of Gajendra, the elephant, because he was living on the Trikuta Mountain, which is an island in the ocean of milk. And one of these ring-shaped oceans is the ocean of milk on Jambudvipa. And you see that there are demigods playing in the different caves of that mountain, and so on. Gajendra was an elephant, and he was attacked by a crocodile, but the battle between them went on for 1,000 years. So it wasn't an ordinary elephant and an ordinary crocodile. So the question then is, if in fact Bhumandala is a plane extending through vast regions of space, far away from this earth as we know it, well, where is that plane? How are we to understand it in relation with the rest of the solar system? Well, in fact, you can provide some tentative answers to that question, which can help aid one in interpreting the fifth canto. And the way to know where Bhumandala is situated in outer space is to consider the motion of the sun. So, in Bhumandala, there is a particular ring-shaped mountain on one of these dvipas, or ring-shaped islands, which is called the Manasotara Mountain. So it's a huge ring. Let's see, the radius of that ring is in the order of something like 100 million miles or so. I forget the exact figure, but it's very large. And it is centered on Jambudvipa. So it's described that the sun is riding on a chariot above this ring-shaped mountain. Apparently in India they have a thing called an oil-pressing machine in which you have a sort of ring-shaped track. You have a single wheel and a central axis, and oxen move around in a circle, and the wheel rotates on the ring, and the axis revolves around. And you put whatever you want pressed under the wheel, and it crushes it as it moves along. So that's an oil-pressing machine. Well, this chariot of the sun is described as being like an oil-pressing machine in which the wheel runs along this Manasotara Mountain, and the central axis connects to Jambudvipa. So the sun is moving along just above Manasotara Mountain. The distance above the mountain is 100,000 yojanas. Now that is a considerable distance, but a more exact figure for the radius of this ring from here up to here is 15,146,000 yojanas. So the ratio between the height of the sun above the ring and the ring itself is 151, is what it comes out to. So the point is, when looked at in scale, the sun is practically on the plane of Bhumandala, and it's moving around that mountain on a circular track. So that means that if you look at the sun in the sky, whatever point on Bhumandala the sun is above at that moment, is very close to the direction you're looking in the sky, because the sun is very close to that point from a vantage point here. So if you consider how the sun moves in the sky, and you consider that the sun is moving around Bhumandala on this circular track, then you can tell where Bhumandala must be situated in the sky. So the basic conclusion one arrives at from that is that the plane of Bhumandala corresponds to the path of the sun through the sky, and that is called the ecliptic. So I should say a little bit about how the movement of the sun looks from a point of view on the Earth. So there is something called the celestial sphere. If you take the Earth globe, imagine a very large sphere centered on the Earth, you know, enormous. And what you do is you take the latitude and longitude lines on the Earth and you project them out onto that sphere. So there's an equator going around that sphere, which is called the celestial equator. And you get that just by projecting out the equator of the Earth. There are two poles, the north and south celestial pole, which you obtain by just extending the north pole until it hits the sphere at the north end and extending it in the southern direction to hit the sphere at the southern end, and the different lines of celestial latitude and longitude. So this is called the celestial sphere. Now, against this sphere, the sun moves on a particular path, which is a great circle on that sphere. And that circle is tilted at an angle of about 23.5 degrees from the celestial equator. And the sun moves in that path in one year through one complete circuit. And that path is called the ecliptic. So the reasoning given here, and I'm not going into the details, one has to look at the particular verses in the Bhagavatam and so forth, suggests that the plane of Bhumandala corresponds to the plane of the ecliptic. So if you want to, in a crude way, relate Bhumandala with the picture of the solar system that we have in Western terms, Bhumandala corresponds to the plane of the sun's orbit, of the Earth's orbit around the sun, or equivalently, the sun's orbit around the Earth, depending on which you want to take as fixed. So in that case, the radical suggestion that the fifth canto is making in connection with modern astronomy is that the plane of the solar system is not empty space, except for a few planets like the Earth, the Moon, and so forth, plus various asteroids and meteors and comets and so forth. Instead of being empty space, there's actually an inhabited realm out there, which in fact is inhabited by beings on the level of demigods and so forth. So the Vedic literature is saying that that's out there. Now, of course, we don't see that. If you look in outer space with a telescope, you won't see Bhumandala. You just see empty space in that plane. But the Vedic literature is saying, well, there's an inhabited realm there. So there's that basic point. Now, once you've identified the location of Bhumandala, if we just proceed with this identification, then the upper planetary systems must be in the direction of celestial north from Bhumandala. So if you take the plane of the ecliptic, and if you position yourself, you can determine where that is. In San Diego, I can point it out. I'm not able to do that here. But from that plane, you can determine where the pole star is, which indicates the direction of north. And going north from the plane of the ecliptic, you'd have the various planetary systems in the upper direction. And going towards the south from the plane of the ecliptic would be the lower planetary systems. So according to this idea, towards the south, you would have the Garbhodak Ocean and so forth. So of course, all you see are stars at night, and you can be sure that in ancient India, people also just saw stars when they looked out in the sky at night, except perhaps for some yogis and mystics who might see a different thing. But in any event, a person with ordinary vision will just see stars. But outer space is divided up in this way. So in this way, it begins to make sense that you have a svarga, a bauma svarga, and a bila svarga. It's all svarga because it's all out there, except for the very tiny part of Jambudvipa, which passes through where we are, which is provides the earth itself. Now that gives a beginning of an idea of how Bhumandala relates to the solar system and the earth as we know it, but still there are a lot of unanswered questions. One basic question is, how does the earth globe, as we understand it, relate to this plane with these enormous mountains, which are typically larger than the earth itself? So this is an area where one can only offer tentative answers. But if you study the Bhagavatam and the kinds of things described there, you begin to get a certain understanding that does seem to make sense. And that is essentially that this system is of a higher dimensional nature. I use the word higher dimensional loosely. It's one of the most convenient terms to use to refer to this idea. But the idea is that you can have worlds existing in parallel to the world we see, which are not accessible to our senses, and which are accessible to the senses of persons with a greater degree of mystic power or a higher elevation of consciousness. So that for a human being, it is not possible to see this larger structure in the universe, but a demigod could actually travel there and see that. Narada Muni could do so, certain yogis could do so, and so forth. So that's in a simple form, the basic idea. You find many descriptions in the Vedic literature of how demigods can travel in a way that to us looks completely mysterious. From our point of view, they simply appear in a given place, and then they disappear. From their point of view, they're traveling. So, very briefly, that would be the answer I would suggest for this. There are many different points that are relevant to this. If you go through Srila Prabhupada's books, you'll find a number of interesting descriptions of Bhumandala. In several places in Srila Prabhupada's books, he describes Bhumandala as a system of globes floating in space. You can see that in particular in the Krishna book, in the section where Krishna and Arjuna are going to see Mahavishnu. They take off in Krishna's chariot and they travel north over various planetary systems. And Srila Prabhupada describes the dvipas as islands in the ocean of floating in the ocean of air. Now the Bhagavatam directly describes these dvipas as geographical subdivisions of a plane, but in certain places Srila Prabhupada refers to them as globes floating in space. Now likewise, the Bhagavatam describes Jambudvipa as part of the geography of this plane of Bhumandala, but our own experience is that the earth is a globe floating in space. Also, the Surya Siddhanta describes the earth as a globe floating in space, and it has the right diameter for it. So there seems to be some parallelism here. We have on the one hand a description of globes floating in space, and on the other hand, we have a description of planes and celestial scale geography with mountains bigger than the earth and so forth. So it would appear to me, one can at least suggest, that there is a correlation between these in the sense that both of these descriptions are referring to one reality, but from different aspects. And can I make that more exact? I don't think at this point it's wise to try to make it more exact. We see the two descriptions and the parallelism, and we see that there is one reality being described here. I would suggest that there's a higher dimensional connection between the globes floating in space, including this Earth, and the cosmic geography type description you have in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Now, a number of interesting points can be made that fill out this picture. There are many references in Srila Prabhupada's books which identify specific parts of Bhumandala, which, according to the fifth canto, are many thousands of yojanas in size, or hundreds of thousands of yojanas, with identifying these with particular parts on the surface of the earth, which are very small. as small regions and so forth. So we seem to have a principle of correspondence between celestial features in this Bhumandala and geographical areas on the earth. But if you think about it, you'll see a lot of this kind of thing in the Vedic literature. For example, nearly all of the rivers in India have celestial counterparts. Of course, the Ganges is the most famous example. We see the Ganges flowing in India, and to ordinary mundane eyes, the Ganges seems to come out of a sort of area of ice up in the Himalayas at a certain point. On the other hand, we know from Vedic literature that the Ganges is a celestial river, which at a certain point appears on the earth and then continues on its path. It actually begins at the upper covering of the universe near the pole star and comes all the way down to the earth. In purports in different places, Srila Prabhupada points out that many different rivers in India are of a similar nature. You have a celestial river and a counterpart on the earth. So it would appear that this earth that we see has different parts which are counterparts of this Bhumandala description. Exactly how the connection works is hard to say. I can give you another piece of information that also sheds some light on this, but relates to this idea of celestial rivers and so forth. A yogi, Srila Prabhupada has pointed out, can travel from one place to another by, say, going into the Ganges at one place and emerging at another place. That can be done on the earth. You can go in the Himalayas and emerge at Allahabad or something like that. It's not that you swim underwater, but it's a mystic transfer. Likewise, it's described in the Bhagavatam in one place that the four Kumaras enter the Ganges up near Brahma Loka, where they were living, and they emerged in the vicinity of Garbhadakshai Vishnu, because they wanted to go meet Ananta Shesha. It describes that their hair was wet when they came out. So this kind of mystical travel is possible. So in the Bhagavatam, and the Vedic literature in general, you have the idea of modes of travel which are inconceivable from the point of view of our ordinary ideas of space. But some extraordinary idea of space is implicit in the Vedic literature. So maybe we should stop now and you can ask questions. Yeah?
Obviously, one starts trying to figure out how you could account for the observable phenomena by thinking in terms of a multi-dimensional reality projected into three dimensions. I'm thinking, like you were saying, you made the remark that yogis, perhaps with a different type of senses, might perceive things differently. Different kinds of bodies might also be able to, evidently are able to travel through regions which we can. If you imagine that we are like limited three-dimensionally, then you know it may be that that's understandable, that you have all these, if we had a higher dimensional kind of body and senses, maybe we could also do like Alice in Wonderland and pass through the mirror and do a completely different area of Jambudvipa, for instance.
If you ask, what is the relation between this fifth canto description and what we normally think of, or between that and the Suryasiddhanta, which amounts to the same thing because it agrees closely to what we normally think of. What is the relation? The main difference is that the fifth canto description posits a lot more different entities existing in the solar system than we experience, or that we posit in our own picture. By our own, I mean what we're accustomed to thinking of. So, of the things that are there, there are some discrepancies between our picture and the fifth canto picture. I described some of those, but there's a broad agreement. So you could say the fifth canto, at least on a broad level, is describing the same kind of motion of planets in the sky and so forth. It is simply positing that out there in the sky, extending over this vast plain, there is an inhabited world that in the Bhagavatam is called the Earth. Or not Earth, of course, it's called Bhumandala. So we don't see that, obviously. But Bhagavatam says that it's there. Now, in the Vedic literatures, there are many descriptions of parallel worlds. starting with Vrindavan, obviously. The whole spiritual world is present in Vrindavan. And even Brahma, with his ordinary vision, couldn't see it there until Krishna revealed it to him. And then Brahma was utterly stunned to the point that he fainted upon seeing that. So even a being with the senses of Brahma could not see the total spiritual world that is right there in Vrindavan, unless Krishna revealed it to him. So another example is the Navadvip Mahatmya by Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes a parallel reality, if you like, in the area of Mayapur, in which all kinds of pastimes are going on. And it's a description of how Jiva Goswami went on a parikram with Lord Nityananda. And at different points, he was able to actually see these different pastimes that are going on there all the time. Other times, he couldn't see them, but it's actually there. So there are many descriptions of this kind. So in the Vedic literature, you definitely have the idea of what you might call parallel realities or higher dimensional realities, which are not directly accessible to our senses, but which are accessible to senses that are suitably elevated.
Du har lyttet til en udsendelse fra Radio Krishna, og specifikt hørte vi en optagelse fra Belgien i Radhadesh-templet, hvor Sataputta, vores videnskabsmand, talte om astronomi, den vediske astronomis forhold til den vestlige astronomi. Det var Yadunandan Das, der stod for produktionen af denne udsendelse. Han var også jeres studievært. Jeg siger tak for nu. Hare Krishna og på genhør.
One morning I was sleeping in the bed, and then I had a sharp pain in my head. I thought, why do I exist, and why do I have to go through this? This seems to be very unnecessary. This world is very contradictory. This religion, that religion, everybody has his own mission. I'm gonna tell you right now, the right way. I'll show you how, a quick way to get you through this, to eternity, knowledge endless. Krishna's to Bhagavan Swayam. He'll show you how to get back home, the home that welcomes you. But now you have to go on a bona fide journey now. Welcome to the path of eternity. Welcome to the path of eternity. Welcome to the path of eternity. Check it out, check it out. Welcome to the path of eternity. The path of eternity. Welcome to the path of eternity. Check it out, check it out, yo. This spiritual master will get you through a worldly material disaster faster. Our guru is the spirit of God. He tells us that it's Maya that you have to dodge. You don't do this and you do that. You follow instructions so you won't come back. If it's spiritual qualities that you lack, then it's reincarnation, now that's a fact. Utsaha nishtayat dariyat. Follow this nectar and your pain will stop. So sit back, relax, put on your bike, meet the gear. Get ready for a spiritual atmosphere. I don't need this world because I'm not alone. Now it's time for me to go back home. You're not this and that, you're thinking with the fleshly me. Try to concoct false identity. Read the Vedas and then you'll see with the eyes of knowledge and eternity. Krishna is what you see when you go to the temple and you worship the deity. It's not an idol that'll make you say what the, but it's spoken as a beta beta tawa. Now it's time to find because you're blind. Once you follow this fleshly body, you'll be left behind, begging for the nectar of the holy name. Once you follow this path, then your eyes will remain the same. And then you see that it's not a game, that Krishna is the one that controls the rain. Sarva kara na kara na. Spirit is the one beyond thought and reason. And in this life you think your life is pleasing. Spirit jumps and changes season. It's always one verse that we have to remember. So look at the date and change your calendar. Because matras pasos te conteya chitos nasuke duke dachise. And then we see beyond the skies above. We'll reach Krishnaloka full of bliss and love. And on this path we'll never lose. Because to get back home, this is the way to choose. So groove. on this last path, and if you follow this path, you'll get home fast. And on this road, it's not three or two, but it's the way. Now it's up to you.